Nerdogram Podcast. The ultimate mashup between the Enneagram personality tool and all your favorite characters from film, TV, and literature. On today's episode, we are typing the characters from Timeline. Hey everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of the Nerdogram Podcast. My name is Lance.
My name is Kate.
Kate, how was your vacation?
It was good. The thing about vacationing with children, with small children, I don't know if this is true for older kids, but it's really a trip where you pay a lot of money to parent your children in other more expensive places. But we did have fun.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. And as I told you, you haven't done that kind of vacation until somebody cries. Be it you or your children. It's not real till their tears.
Our audience should know that Lance, who is also a travel agent who is helping us with our trip to Disney, was asking just throughout the day how it was going and sending some helpful information. And at one point I sent him was it a photograph or was it a video?
Oh, it was a video of him under the table crying.
Yes. Yeah. My four-year-old spent 25 minutes of our 30-minute lunch sitting under the table crying. The reason is the best. The hot dog bun. Which he doesn't eat hot dog buns. Keep in mind, he only eats the hot dog. But the bun that was the vehicle for the hot dog broke slightly. And he just couldn't deal. So he crawled underneath the table and cried. And there was nothing, like we could not get him up. We tried bribery. We tried threats. We tried, you know, consequences. I even offered to let him play with my phone. And that was a bad move. Cause I'm just thinking like, oh, we're here. We want everybody to be happy. There are other people who are staring because our kid is crying and we're just sitting at the table eating while our kid's under the table. And then he just decided he wanted to play with my phone underneath the table, which I said no to. So it was like this backfired.
No, they just stared at you. My experience at Disney has been a camaraderie that I've not found anywhere else, where you get the loving looks of the parent going, yep, that's going to be us in 5 minutes, like teamwork. And I've even gotten high fives and given high fives to their parents. Like, we got this. We got this. We're all in it together. This is a magical moment.
That's awesome. Maybe I was projecting my own fear of what people were thinking, but I did do that to somebody else. We were, my husband and I took a day by ourselves, which was awesome. We went to Universal and we were sitting down in Diagon Alley and there was a young mom who was on a scooter and she had like a 2-year-old child at her feet and she was breastfeeding another one and operating the scooter. And I like shouted across Nocturne Alley, like, you go, mama, you are awesome. Like, you're just amazing. Like multitasking at its finest. This is like a tiny baby. I also saw a dad who was such a pro dad. This was at Disney and he had a very new baby, like maybe 3 to 5 weeks, like very new. And the first time I passed him, he was burping. Said baby. He was just like sitting against a wall burping a baby who was crying. And then the next time I walked past him, he was changing the baby's poopy diaper like on his lap and didn't even have like, you know, a changing pad out, which you as a parent know that is not a first kid move. That's something you do when you've had kids, when, you know, you just get over it and just start changing poopy diapers in public on your lap. And if a little bit of poop gets on your pants, like you just wipe it off with a wipe. And I was like, pro dad right there.
That's a dad that's seen some things.
A dad that's seen a lot of feces.
He probably ended up on that Disney Daddies. Have you seen this?
You told me about it.
Guaranteed, you know, something about a dad showing up and doing just the barest minimum of work that a mom was expected to do gets big creds, you know.
Well, one of the things that I did on the way back from vacation is I started listening to our audiobook for this month, Timeline by Michael Crichton.
I should have done that. Instead, I got really excited and I read this book really early in the month.
So hopefully it'll just like be coming back to you as we talk about it and remember the characters.
Emerging out of the fogs of time.
Now, do you know a whole lot about Michael Crichton?
No, not a whole lot.
I fell into a black hole on the internet about him, and I had no idea how many things this guy had his hand in. So I'm gonna ask you some questions. I just want to see if you can guess. So he had a career before he became a full-time writer. He wanted to be a writer in his youth, but he saw some statistics that there are only like 200 people in America who earn a living writing full-time. He's like, yeah, I should probably get a different job. That doesn't sound like a good deal. So he got a different job. What do you think that other job would be? It's a profession. Like, you have to go to school for this.
A librarian.
He was a physician.
Really?
He went to Harvard for undergrad, got a degree in anthropology, then went to Harvard Medical School, became a doctor, decided it wasn't really for him, started writing books. Oh, and by the way, he also had like a little bit of computer programmer on the side. This guy was super smart, which is really not surprising when you read his books, because it is infused with science and history. And I mean, so many details, languages. It's incredible. This guy is unbelievably intelligent.
Oh yeah. Well, that's what put me onto Timeline was my physics teacher. When I was trying to wrap my head around a particular piece of physics, said, I think you're ready for this book, and handed me Timeline.
That's awesome. So I found myself, we've talked about this on the air before, where he does such a good job in the beginning, making you believe that this could be possible. I mean, you really don't have to suspend reality. It doesn't feel like fantasy. It feels like more science fiction, because he's so good at making a reader believe this kind of technology exists, that it's impossible, like weaving together fact and fiction. But the part that I loved was really like part two of the novel, is once they're in the past, because if our readers haven't picked up on this yet, I'm a history person, and particularly the medieval period. I'm more medieval England is more my thing than France. Although I do have a little bit more knowledge about the area they were in, which is Aquitaine, because the first novel that I wrote, I didn't finish this. I got like 80% in and realized it was garbage and it wasn't going to have a happy ending, and I couldn't bring myself to do it. So I quit. But the first novel that I wrote was set in Aquitaine. And so I had done a lot of research on that area from about 100 years before when Timeline is set. And I was fangirling and geeking and loving all the conversations about culture and architecture and warfare. And I could take a guess that you really enjoyed like the tournament and the armor portions. Am I right about that?
Yes. However, there was some of the same assumptions, because we've learned more since this book was written, particularly around like weights of swords. Merrick has this moment where he was reflecting about the weight of the sword and how easily people are just swinging it casually as they were sort of sparring or playing around. Friends, real medieval swords weighed about 3 pounds. The big ones weighed maybe 3.5-4 pounds. They were not unwieldy, because that gets you killed. So the assumption that because they're these big, fat, heavy swords is actually an assumption that emerged out of the Renaissance and is not accurate. Any real blades? No, it's an annoyance to me. I'm like, well, so many things right, but not that one.
And there's so many things about the medieval period that we guess about. Because the most common things of life, much like today, people didn't write down, because it just seems so obvious that you're never going to, if you're a diarist, for example, you are never going to go in your diary and write about your toilet paper, because one, it's toilet paper, but because it just seems so obvious. Now, future generations will know about toilet paper because they'll be able to see Charmin commercials, but there are just those ordinary things of life that don't get written down, and they don't survive in the historical record for archaeologists to dig up later. And so we just have to guess with those things. And he did a really good job of making it plausible.
Yeah. And some of the things that we believe we know have emerged from findings that we have, because we're still finding manuscripts and documents. And there is a whole host of people like Andre Marek, who he sort of points out, like, that's this new wave of people who are trying to experience, like, experiential historians. And we have learned so much through that trial and error. And so since this book has come out, like, there's a whole host of research that's been done. And then people try this stuff. I belonged for a time to a group that just tried to learn these things. And a lot of it was trial and error. They'd say, okay, here's what we've read. Here's what's been discovered. Here's the gaps. Let's see if we can get from point A to point B and how we do this weaving. Let's try and build the trundle beds, and we're going to actually sleep on them and figure out, is this comfortable? Would anyone have slept on this? Oh, nope, that's not clearly we did something wrong. Let's figure this out. Let's see what we can learn. And that's opened up some things, some really interesting things.
I love it. Well, are you ready to jump in and start talking about some of the characters in addition to this plot and the story?
Let's hop in.
Okay. Well, the first character that we're going to talk about is in the book. His name is David Stern. If you are someone who has watched the movie, which is totally okay, we enjoy the movie for what it is as well. I think both of us probably say the book is much, much superior, but the movie is a fun time too. In the movie, this character is named Josh Stern. Not entirely sure why they changed his name, but they did. We're going to refer to him as David because that's what he is in the book. So Lance, do you have any initial hunches for what Enneagram number you might think David is?
Sort of. I more feelings than any deep, solid hunch. I think I can scratch out more things. He's not a nine. He's principled, but he doesn't necessarily feel like a one. His motivations to go and engage in this dig are kind of funny, right? He goes because he just wants to be close to his girlfriend. So that tells me he's not really invested in what they're doing, but he does deeply care, and he does tend towards competency in what he does.
I agree. So unlike the rest of the crew, David is actually a physicist. He is not a historian or an archaeologist. He signed up to do this dig because his girlfriend was there and they needed someone to basically run their equipment. So he's doing things that are far below his skill set. He's not even doing like carbon dating because they don't have the tech to do that on site. And keep in mind, this book is a little more than 20. It's 20 to 25 years old. So if you're someone who is a tech person, there's been a lot of advancements between when the book was written. But I think you're right. I think he is a competency person, but I also think he's in the fear triad.
I agree wholeheartedly.
So audience, the competency group is referring to harmonic patterns. So how do we react when we don't get what we want or when we're experiencing loss or disappointment? And the competency group are ones, threes, and fives. So they're going to go to logic. They're going to go to problem solving and using their skill sets in order to deal with what's going on. But the fear triad is the five, six, and seven. And so the number that's right in the middle there is the five. We see him being very fearful when he's actually the first to say, I'm not going. Peace out, guys. This does not seem safe to me. And I don't want to do it. And I don't think you really need me. And Andre agrees. Like, we probably don't need you. He's not a historian. He doesn't know the period. He doesn't know the culture. He's honestly more of a liability and he doesn't want to be there. So it's like, let's give you an out. And thank goodness they did that because he was needed on the other end when things don't go as expected. His skill set is much more valuable being in the present where he's able to work with technology. And his skill set comes in handy because he's a problem solver. He's incredibly observant. He has one of the things that Michael Crichton does is he has these images in his mind where his brain is trying to solve the problem and giving him ideas, but he hasn't put together all the pieces of the puzzle. And so he keeps thinking about cars and tires and And he comes to realize that his brain is pushing him in the right direction to solve this massive problem of being able to rebuild, basically having to rebuild the machine to bring them all home. And that seems to me like something a five, like the way a five's brain might work.
It does. And I feel like people come to recognize the value of the opinion of a five pretty quickly and turn to a five and say, this is a person who knows what they're talking about. Somewhere they have stored back the information that's going to be helpful. And they're ready to offer him a job at this place because he just pops off with these things. He knows where there's gaps. He can, because he's an observer, because he studies lots of things, he realizes they're only giving him part of the story whenever they want to send him back. And I think that's about being safe.
I agree. I feel good about typing him as a five.
I do as well. What do you think about the big baddie in this story? Don't you love how often Michael Crichton's characters, the people who are the worst, work for corporate?
I wonder what he's trying to tell us about there.
Rupert Doniger.
At different points, I was wondering if Doniger was a three, a five, and an eight. There are so many interesting things about this character. And even points where I was like, well, that sounds a little four-ish, where he's not one of those characters that is, I think, easy to type accurately, because I feel like you could make a good argument for a lot of different things. I do think I have a number in mind, but I want to kind of lay out what aspects of each of those numbers I saw in him. The three, because he is, as you pointed out pre-recording, someone who's willing to cut some corners. He wants it to be good. It's not that he doesn't want it to be good, but he's not a perfectionist. And he's very scheming and conniving. He cares very much about the image and the brand, not necessarily of himself, but of the brand that he's creating. And his plan is ultimately about making money and succeeding and creating a tourism industry for traveling to the past. I don't think he's a four, but he had this long speech where he talks about authenticity. And there were hints of a four in that. And he also is someone who is very creative. He's an outside the box thinker. He doesn't strike me as someone who's emotive, although he's very moody. And that's something to take into account. I don't think he is a four because we don't see the wide range of emotions. He kind of has a couple switches. But I did wonder when he has a strong sense of like authenticity. But ultimately, I don't think that's who he is. I think that's part of the brand. I don't think he cares about authenticity. I think he's selling something. I wondered about a five because he is brilliant. And he is someone who knows a lot about a very specialized niche. And a five can take on the energy of an eight and can be very aloof and very uncaring while also being very aggressive in their presentation, and can come off like an eight. Or an eight can kind of be a five when they're really unhealthy. They can gravitate towards the withdrawing, lack of compassion, hoarding side of a five. And eights are unhealthy. Eights are notoriously bad bosses and can be very abrasive and not just straightforward. All eights are straightforward. A really unhealthy eight will be abrasive in how they present things. And that is definitely Doniger. So there are, I would say, three numbers that rose to the top for me, the four kind of just being like, there's some four-ish statements there. What about you? What were you thinking with Doniger?
I lean towards the three, and I hear what you're saying about seeing that speech from the four. I don't see that as coming from him. I see that as market research. Mm-hmm. You know, he's looking at one-upping Disney, and there was a big movement at that time that people were trying to recreate Disney except authentic. And so it feels like he's trying to build something big for himself, this legacy. You know, he doesn't need the money, but he can convey to other people the vision of building something that matters, something that's important, something that has both monetary and kind of philanthropic things to it, right? That there's going to be this community that develops. We're going to learn so much about history. We're going to be able to rediscover things. It feels like he's building himself his legacy. You know, he's doing his success is going to be worth it in the end. And you get this sense that that's what he's trying to protect, is making sure that all of the sacrifices that he's made up until this point aren't ruined by these group of people who just kind of got lost in time.
I'm not sure. I have thought three pretty strongly. What I don't see that I would expect to see with a three would be more concern about his own personal image. And I don't feel like I see the same like desire for legacy. Certainly he is building a brand, and I'm 100% with you about the four being market research and that being a spiel. And he is, he loves working a room and controlling a room. And we even get some conversations in Kramer's head about how he sees that as like proving that he's smart and that he's like on top of things, like on top of the world almost. That's not a quote from the book, but I got the impression. But she also makes a statement, Kramer, or in Kramer's head, that Doniger doesn't care what anyone thinks about him. He genuinely doesn't. Mm-hmm. And
it's true.
That is not a three. Threes care very much what people think about them. And for me, I went back and forth, and I'm still not convinced. Is he competency? Because he is smart and he is a good problem solver, and he's totally ruthless. Like, there are no like moral restraints that this guy has. Or is he reactive? Because he exercises very little self-control. Even when he's supposed to be like schmoozing or getting people on his side, you know, he's telling them that they're stupid and calling everyone assholes. Like, there's a whole spiel about how many people he calls an asshole who works for him, and people continue to work for him because he's creating something worth creating.
You know, I'm not sure.
I'm kind of leaning at this particular moment. I might feel differently in 2 minutes, but at this particular moment, I think I'm leaning towards an eight, a very unhealthy eight who has no moral constraints on him. And leaning into that five, where he is not compassionate, where he does not care about people, where he is hoarding wealth, where it is 100% about his goal, and he doesn't care who he hurts or mows down in an effort to get what he wants. He's very controlling. He has to be in charge and be the boss.
I'm not opposed to it. I don't feel like we see a lot of them, because we don't really see anything through his eyes until the very end.
Mm-hmm. We're not. Yeah, you're right. We're not in his head. We're viewing him through the lens of mostly Kramer and Doniger and briefly the team. I think he's a three or an eight. I feel really comfortable narrowing it to one of those. But there's a lot of different. I mean, they're both in the aggressive stance. They're both people who are going to go after what they want. And he is more manipulative than a lot. But he's also not charming or schmoozing. He lies. But he doesn't misrepresent his person so much as he misrepresents the brand. He's selling the brand, but he's not necessarily selling himself. And threes tend to be selling themselves and their own personal brand. So I don't know. Maybe this is the place our audience can give us some clarity.
Yeah, I'd be interested to hear, because he doesn't feel like an eight to me. You're making really compelling points. I see all those things, but he just, I don't know.
He's definitely slimy and unhealthy threes. Mm-hmm. You kind of have like that slimy sense.
Yeah.
But he's such a jerk to his staff. Such a jerk. And maybe I just have associations of a handful of Enneagram eights who are really unhealthy in leadership positions. And maybe I'm making those connections, but.
I mean, I can picture a couple of those people.
Yeah. And the way he treats his employees as inferiors, I guess that to me, and the way he's so straightforward in what he thinks about you, like most threes are tactful. Like, I don't think that's the idea that we're going for. Let's get back to the drawing board. Let's keep thinking. And in their head, they're thinking, you're an effing idiot, but they're not going to like say that. Whereas Doniger's like, are you stupid? How do you have a job here? Because you're obviously a stupid person. I don't know. I feel like I could go either direction for him.
Yeah. He's just not a nice person. I mean, that's not an Enneagram type. Does anyone weep for Doniger when he goes and gets the Black Plague?
No. I love how at the end, like, he sits down and then he coughs. I love that line.
Which I don't know enough about the Black Plague. Does it really set in that fast that he literally walked up to one person and immediately gets the cough?
No.
I didn't think so.
No. Okay. And I mean, not that I'm a physician, but there would probably be an incubation period of it, of one day, at least one day, and then
more than 30 seconds.
But there are, so now this is early, but have you heard of the sweating sickness?
Yes.
Yeah. So this is more of a 15th, 16th mm-hmm. century thing, but the sweating sickness, now I don't know how long the incubation period is, but the onset really was incredible. Like, you could wake up and just kind of like not feel great in the morning and be dead by the afternoon. Mm-hmm. Like, it really was that quick. And we, like, modern scholars and physicians have no idea. I mean, we're assuming that it's viral. We have no idea what virus caused it or what made it go away. Kind of crazy.
Yeah, that is absolutely bonkers. Well, I'm looking forward to the wisdom of our listeners to weigh in on Doniger, because I hope you all saw something that I didn't that could clear this up, or that I've forgotten since I read the book and then did other things. But I think we need to go to someone who I feel is the polar opposite of Doniger. He is the guy who has all the keys of the kingdom. And then we have someone who is a powerhouse, who's getting it done on her own in terrible situations, Lady Claire.
I really like Lady Claire. She is so scrappy and self-reliant. I'm trying to think of the best way to describe her. She's cunning, not in a cruel way, because a lot of times we use the word cunning in a very negative way, but she's cunning in a positive sense, where she is thinking things through, problem solving, playing the hand that she's dealt, and using whatever is available to her to try to make a way forward. And she's in a very vulnerable situation. She's very young. What was she, 22? Mm-hmm. So she's 22 years old. She's a widow. It's implied that she has children, because there's a line where she says, like, as a widow and a mother. We never hear about these children, but it's implied that she has them. And she is a foreigner. She's English. Her French husband died. She can't get access to his lands for herself, for her children. These powerful men have moved in. She's in the middle of a war. And one guy's actually trying to sell her hand in marriage. The guy who wants to marry her plans to sell her husband's property. And she's trying to navigate a way through while keeping her life and getting what belongs to her, the land that was her husband's, for herself, for her children, and hopefully getting home where she's a little bit safer. And that's a really, really difficult situation. And we see Claire, even though she is working for self-preservation, she's also helping others. She is not a person who is entirely selfish. She is saving Chris's life in the very beginning when she's dressed up as a boy and he's basically incompetent, and she's putting herself at risk to try to help him survive. She goes out on a limb for Andre and Kate and Chris at different points. She's doing things that she doesn't want to do, like sleeping with the abbot, because that's what she needs to do. And she has zero self-pity. And she actually looks at them and says, don't judge me, because I'm in a hard situation. And you better believe I'm going to do everything that I have to do in order to get through it. And I think there are a lot of people, myself included, who under those circumstances would just like want to curl up in a ball and cry and be woe is me. And that's not what she is doing. She's making her way forward. She's barreling a way forward for herself. And I think we're agreed that she feels like a three.
I couldn't agree more. And she manipulates situations in a way that is so beautiful. The way she plays Chris is fantastic. She knows this guy is an idiot, that he doesn't know what he's doing, but she's going to use him because he's a man. Mm-hmm. And because he can navigate these spaces that she can't. And so in many ways, she uses him as her own armor. to navigate through the situation. So clever, so smooth. And her steward recognizes what she's doing. And she's like, this poor kid, I'm at least going to try and keep him from getting killed. Like, this kid has no idea what he's in.
Yes. I love it when he sees her with the other man. Is it Sergei? Uh-huh. And we're in Chris's head, or his point of view, and he's realizing that she played him, and he can't even feel like that angry about it. He's more of like mad at himself for how he was just so flattered by this beautiful woman's attention and her little kiss that she gave him. And she doesn't even, or he's just realizing, huh, man, I am a goofball, like that kind of thing. And kind of admiring her. Well, he doesn't trust her. That he has some awkward feelings, and Kate doesn't seem to like her very much at all. Kate kind of thinks she's a snake. Andre thinks she's fabulous, and he really admires her ingenuity and her determination, her will to make things happen. He respects her.
Especially after the abbot.
Yes.
There's that moment where he sees and you get a sense that he just approves.
Mm-hmm. She's straightforward. And that's the criticism that Chris and Kate both have of her, is that she's not trustworthy because she's manipulative. And yes, she seems pretty straightforward to me.
Mm-hmm.
She's out for her own best interest, and she's going to do what she needs to do. And there's nothing more more honest than that.
And there's strangers there. They don't know how this works.
Yeah. Yes. And he appreciates that. And that was something, we'll talk more about that with Andre in a minute. Yeah, I'll save that. I'll save what my next thought was for when we're talking about Andre. But I really think Claire is a three, because she's an aggressive number or assertive. That stance, how do you go about getting what you want, is a stance, and she goes for it, and she just does it. And she's not a seven where she's adventure seeking, and she's not an eight where she's without tact or abrasive, or often women eights wrongly and unfairly but get the title of bitch, because that's like the assertiveness of their presence and how they feel to others. And that's not fair, but that's what our world has created roles for men and women. Men who are eights are strong. Women who are eights are bitchy. But she doesn't come off that way. And so her cunning and her manipulation, but her determination and will, that's a three.
Absolutely. Pennant, she's a three. She's girl bossing her way through this.
She is. And she ends up having a good life with my book boyfriend, Andre Merrick.
So you want to be with Merrick. And I just think Merrick is the coolest.
He is so cool. We're both also like kind of geeky about some similar things. And Merrick is geeky in ways that's similar to what we are. Immediately, I had Andre narrowed down to one of three numbers, because he is faux show in the competency harmonic group.
Absolutely.
So that's a 1, 3 and a 5. And he's not a three. Like, he does not care about status. He doesn't care about what people think about him. So for me, it was always, is he a 1 or a 5?
And I had some 4 tendencies that I saw in him, because he's kind of quirky in his own way. And he's sort of trying to find his place. And that made me feel a little bit, you've met people who are sort of a person out of their time, and you think you would be awesome in a different time period. That would be your moment, but you're here and now you're weird. And Merrick feels a little bit like that until he ends up back. And I just want to say one thing about the story that drives me nuts about the thing. Like, I absolutely am on board with this idea that you're opening up a wormhole. You're traveling to another alternate reality in the multiverse. If you travel to another reality, it doesn't make sense that you could leave evidence for people to find you in your current time stream. That doesn't make sense. Like, you're in a different reality. Why would that then be in that reality? So that's a little aside. So if someone knows the answer to this, please shoot me a message. I'm curious. But Andre in the movie leaves evidence of himself, right? Because he loses the ear, and then we get that little endearing thing with him and Lady Claire, and they're buried together and all that. Nope. Don't buy it.
You're right. That there are some issues with that if you're going to another universe.
Which is not helpful in typing, Merrick.
No, it's not. And it's like, oh, this is a plot hole. But I don't want to think about that as a plot hole because I loved that part. Well, so I like how you pointed out a person out of their time where there are things, and this is the problem of a four. There are things about fours. Usually they have like a thing and it's incredible, but sometimes they don't fit in. And Andre is someone who doesn't fit in, but he is not the emotional roller coaster that is a four. He's not self-reflective. He does not sit on his own emotions. He's not doing repressed. He's very active, which is something that I wondered. He has a lot of energy, and I wasn't sure if a five would have as much energy as him. But when we think about the one and the five, both of them have a relationship with the four, because a five can have a four wing where they have a little bit of that four energy or flavor, if you will. And ones move to four when they're in stress and can take on some of those negative four behaviors. So those four elements would work if he's a one or a five.
That's true. I don't think he's a five. The amount of things he gets done by the end of the book, he has quite a body count. I didn't keep track, but he kills a lot of people in this book.
He does.
Which speaks to his competency. Mm-hmm. But he's also driven by an internal sense. He's very gut driven. He has an instinct for where they go, what they need to be doing. And when he's at his best, he's listening to his instincts, which makes me lean more towards the one.
I ultimately landed at the one as well, but I really wasn't sure because I thought for probably 80% of the book, he is a five who's integrated and he is taking on the best qualities of an eight. He has more energy. He's an authoritative leader. He can take charge. He can make decisions because eights are also instinctual. He is very logical. He doesn't stop to think about his feelings. He's going to do what is the next like best thing to do in a hard circumstance. He is unflappable. He's very calm. He never gets worked up. So I really thought that he must be a five because I didn't see anything in him that made me think he was operating from a moral compass or that he was needing to be good, whatever his notion of being good was. And actually that instance that we just talked about with Lady Claire, when she comes out having had sex with the abbot and he's totally okay with that, that made me think, well, he must not be a one because a one would probably have an opinion about the ethics of that, of essentially prostituting herself to get what she needs. I mean, that's more or less what it is. And of course, you're not all ones have the same sense of right and wrong, but he wasn't, how do I put this nicely? Ones have a way of making others aware of what they believe is right and wrong, and sometimes in healthy ways and sometimes in annoying and unhealthy ways. And I didn't see any of that from him until we get to the end or towards the end when they're blowing up the mill and Kate and Andre have been separated from Chris and only one of them is going to get out. And so Andre goes to fight the soldiers so that Kate can get out. And then she and Chris get back together and they believe Andre is dead. And he makes this comment about, you know, he always talked about the chivalry and all this stuff. And it just seemed like, I don't know, this fantasy that he had. And then they're talking to each other. He really believed this. He really is this person. He really was willing to give up his life, to save someone else, to protect women, to fight for what he believes is right. And that was a moment where that was a turning point for me. That maybe he could be a one, and what his compass or his North Star was, this idea of chivalry that has been directing his whole life to the point that he chooses to stay. And the professor even makes a comment at the end this is what his whole life has been pointed towards. Mm-hmm. And that was his moral compass, if you will, was what seemed very antiquated to others or fantastical, was really his guiding point. And that would make sense of the energy that he has. He does like to coach. We see that at the beginning where he's teaching others how to use a broadsword and how to shoot the bow and arrow. And he does tell Chris when he's with Sophie, like, this girl's using you, man. Like, this is not what you think it is. So he is drawn to that teaching and coaching that a lot of ones, particularly social ones, like, and social ones can look a lot like fives. And he has a point of interest and expertise like a five, but his motivation is not to accumulate knowledge. His motivation is to live into an ideal. And for him, that ideal is a chivalry and knighthood.
Yes. That's it. That's it for me.
Yeah. He's a one.
He's a one. So I think for some of these others, we're probably going to need to do a rundown.
Agreed.
And Kate, I think we should start with Kate.
She's so well named.
Great name. Completely different character from the film to the book.
Yes. And I haven't seen the film in at least 10 years, maybe more like 15. But she is a much fiercer character in the book than she is in the movie. And so is Lady Claire, which, okay. So we talked about this a little bit pre-recording. I think it's we, but definitely I have a beef with the movie, which Michael Crichton did not write this screenplay, and it shows. He helped write, I think he did write Jurassic Park screenplay and was like a producer for the film. And I think we can all agree that Jurassic Park is an incredibly well-made film. Certainly the original. I haven't seen any of the more recent ones, but the original was very well done, and Steven Spielberg is incredible. But from the book to the film, several women that are in the book that are pretty important characters, they're side characters. They're not like the main three or four, but they're important to the plot of the story. In the movie, they're turned into men because they're like bosses. And then the women that remain women, only the women who become love interests are in the movie. And they're basically there to be love interests. They aren't doing any of, frankly, the badass stuff that they're doing in the book, which is so disappointing. Like Hollywood, I know it's been 20 years and you're doing a little bit better, but Michael Crichton wrote some really incredible, believable, real, powerful, competent women. And they're really not portrayed that way in the movie. So, Kate, I'm sorry for what they did to you in the movie. But anyway, we're going to do a quick rundown for her. I do not think Kate is a one.
I do not think Kate is a one either. She, while getting a little bit prudish with Lady Claire, I think that's the only instance I see any sort of judginess or perfectionism in her.
Agreed.
Do you think Kate's a two?
No. She doesn't seek attention or approval.
No, she really doesn't.
Do you think she could be a three?
There's a certain level of competency to her. Mm-hmm. I don't know that she's success oriented.
I think if she were a three, it would have been a lot harder for her to leave architecture and transition to history. Mm-hmm. Because one gets a lot more approval, one's going to make a lot more money. It would fit in with her friends.
Right.
More. And she still made that change and is really happy about that change. And that was a very easy change for her to make, which just doesn't feel like a three. Threes really struggle to not meet others' expectations.
Right. Do you think she is a four?
Maybe. She doesn't really feel like a four to me, but there are a few instances that could be four-ish. So for example, early in the book, there's this discussion about how she changed disciplines. And one of the things they say is that she hated new buildings because they were fake. And even buildings that were a couple hundred years old because they were mimicking architecture from previous eras. And she can't stand the inauthenticity of it. And I think they even use that word inauthentic. Mm-hmm. And she had a visceral reaction to it. She is also someone that is comfortable with her own company. She's not anti-people, but she doesn't need a lot of people. I'm not sold that she's a four, but I'm open to the possibility of it, I guess.
I'm with you. Her relationship with Chris is interesting. She kind of holds him at arm's length. And I know this is part of the progression of the characters that she grows closer towards him. Yeah, maybe.
Chris kind of annoys her in the beginning.
I mean, he kind of annoys all of us in the beginning.
He's a bit of a chump. And Kate sees him that way. Mm-hmm. She's not interested in being his rebound. And apparently Andre had hit on her in the beginning too. And she rebuffed that.
You paused. Were you thinking, Kate, that was just not a good... Why did you reject the advances of the noble knight, Andre?
I was kind of thinking that. I was thinking it too. Would probably not have rejected the advances of... So, well, I mean, that's not entirely true. Because there are plenty of twos who don't want to date or have reasons for not dating someone. And obviously, Andre wasn't her lobster, to use a Friends reference.
Did you say her lobster?
Yeah. Have you not seen that episode in Friends?
No.
Phoebe tells, I don't remember if she's talking about Monica and Chandler or Ross and Rachel, but Phoebe talks about how lobsters mate for life, which I'm not sure is true. And it's coming from Phoebe, so it's not necessarily trustworthy. And so then there's this line where he's like, he's her lobster. That was actually how I told one of my good girlfriends who's obsessed with Friends that I'd met my husband. And he wasn't my husband yet. And we were talking about him and we were getting kind of serious pretty quickly. And I was just like, Jenna, he's my lobster. And that was all she needed. And she defended him to everyone after that. So it's kind of cool. Super but anyway,
cute. That's a cute moment.
It was. Yeah, she seems not emotional enough to me to be a four.
So are you leaning towards a five?
I think she could be a five. She's withdrawing.
She's observant.
She is observant. She is independent.
Mm-hmm.
And fives are fiercely independent. She isn't. I don't think she's aggressive because she's capable of doing what needs to be done. But at no point does she take the lead in all the shenanigans. She's perfectly happy to defer to Andre or to the professor, even to Chris towards the end when he's kind of rising to the challenge. She lets him save her.
So,
I mean, she needed backup. She
needs a big, strong man to come in and do the heavy lifting.
I mean, to be fair, like life and death situations, you're going to take help from whoever you can get it from. But she does defer to him.
Yeah.
But she's competent. Yeah. She's very competent. She's not someone who loses her cool. She stays pretty calm in really harrowing situations. She's also able to detach. I think I'm talking myself into a five because she is able to detach. Like when they find the baby in the burned out building and the mother and like the other child had been killed and the baby's crying. And Andre says, you have to leave it. I couldn't have done that. I would have died because I would have tried to take the baby and then we would have gotten caught. That's what would have happened. I probably would have died sooner than that. But she's able to detach and say, yep, you're right. I can't save this baby and myself. And so I have to hope somebody else finds the baby and I need to move on. And that's a very logical decision that someone, several types wouldn't be able to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think she could be a five.
I'm actually kind of leaning towards the five.
And we're probably going to have a disproportionate number of five-ish characters because we're also working with academics. And I know it's a stereotype that all fives are like nutty professors, but there's a like stereotypes usually have a little bit of truth in them. That's why they become stereotypes. Like when you're in an academic setting, you are going to have a disproportionate number of fives.
A disproportionate number of nerds.
Yeah. She's a little more energetic, but I don't know that she has more emotional energy. I think she just has a little more physical energy, but because she's a climber and she likes rock climbing, but she also likes the serenity and the peace. And I think maybe even like the solitude of her work and climbing. I think she likes that she doesn't spend all of her time with a lot of people.
Yeah.
She strikes me as someone who's withdrawing.
I get the same sense.
But she's not merging like a nine.
No, because I think she would go along with, you know, sort of the Wall Street guys that she hangs out with at the beginning. She did friends with them, but, you know, it's fine. She's not, she doesn't need that.
It also makes sense to me why Chris annoys her so much in the beginning, because he is kind of moody and he's not super competent. And I think fives look for that. Like they respect people who can manage a situation and keep calm, and fives don't want to need to be taken care of. And they also don't want to take care of other people. And so in the beginning, Chris is someone who kind of seems like a little bit babyish. Like he's looking for a mama as much as a girlfriend. And she has no time for that.
I think you just nailed it. He's not looking for a girlfriend. He's looking for a mama.
Well, do you feel like we need to talk about the other numbers for Kate, or do you feel good with the five?
I'm actually kind of happy with the five.
I am as well. Sometimes we just need to talk it out.
Talk it out. Okay.
All right. Last but certainly not least, we have Chris Hughes, who is the character that I think has the most development. And as a character, he's the one that seems like he's actually changes over the course of the 37 hours that he's in the world.
Thank goodness, because for most of it, I'm not sure he can tie his shoes without help.
He's just distracted by all the pretty girls.
Sure. That's what
first
it is.
First Sophie, and then Kate, and then Claire, and then Kate again.
Because people go into archaeology because they're just tired of the runway. You know, all the gorgeous people become scholars.
So this is something that kind of annoys me. This is another change that annoys me in the book. But I guess it kind of makes sense, because in the movie, they change it so that he's not even a historian. He's the son of the professor, and he was only on the site to be visiting his dad, which one of the problems, I don't remember if you were recording or if this was pre-recording. I think it was pre-recording. You, Lance, said when Andre is asked to bring like his three best people, how in the world was Chris on that list? Well, he shouldn't have been on the list. The only reason for him to be one of the top three was if he was the professor's son and therefore should be part of it. I think that makes sense of his character flaw.
It does. And it feels like they were like, we got to fix this. This was a plot hole in the book. And so we're going to solve this. What we're going to do is, clearly Chris has daddy issues. So we're just going to pluck a different kind of daddy issue and drop it into the movie and it'll work.
Also, there is no way, well, maybe for an archaeologist, but he is not labeled as an archaeologist. He's labeled as a historian. There is no way that there would be someone who is a Yale student, a Yale graduate student who is a historian, a medievalist, who isn't competent in Latin, for one, or French. Like, I don't know if people realize this, but you have to, in order to get a PhD, you have to do your competency evaluations. And those, I mean, it changes with your discipline. It's probably different for the sciences. I'm not a science person, but if you're in the humanities, you have to pass a test for, depending on your discipline, a minimum of 2 languages, sometimes up to 4. So in my discipline, you would have to have 4. You have to be competent in 4 languages, 2 of which are ancient and no longer spoken, and 2 which are modern, so that you can read the literature about your discipline, which is why I don't have a PhD, because I knew I would not be able to do that.
You could get there. I'm confident.
Well,
I mean, if Chris can do it, you can certainly do it.
Well, Chris apparently hadn't done it, which does not make sense. Like, he would at least be able to converse in Latin. Now, whether he wouldn't necessarily have the right pronunciation, like his Latin would be archaic, but he would be competent in Latin, and he would have been competent in French and probably some Middle English. And Occitan is a dialect of French, which is what they're speaking in Aquitaine at the time. Andre, like, they make a big point that Andre speaks all these languages. Anyone who studied their period in that region would at least be competent in those languages. Maybe not speaking it, but they would certainly be able to read it.
I was going to say, I could see being able to read it, but it did not transition to the other.
Yeah, it would be hard to speak it, but would not be nearly as clueless as he was. And also, apparently, the only thing he really was studying was the bridge. So I'm not sure what good he was.
And he even got that wrong.
He did. Poor guy.
He just can't win.
To be fair, he was only 24. And, you know, 24 is really young. And he's been in the academic world, so he hasn't had to be, like, in the rat race of job. And he's not married, so he doesn't have family responsibilities. He doesn't have kids. Like, there are lots of things that help you grow up. And he just hasn't done any of those things yet. And when he's in a situation where he's forced to grow up, happily he does. And he turns into a very different kind of person, much more competent, less clueless, happy to be alive. He doesn't complain when he's injured. He doesn't mope. Kate is shocked that he's like, says he's okay and isn't like whining and moaning when he used to whine and moan over not getting the wine that he wanted at dinner. So there's some growth for Chris.
Kate, you were at 25, 24. You were competent in these areas.
Well, yes, that's true. But to be fair, I had a very different vocational experience. And yes, I was in graduate school, but I was married at 23. I was a parent at 25. I had been working full time since I was 20 and going to school. And I'd lived on my own and was mostly financially independent. So there were other things in my life to help me grow up.
That's fair. I just think we get to see Chris as a Rube to start out, and then just less of a Rube as he goes through.
By the end, I like him. I never dislike him. I'm just like waiting for him to shine. I'm waiting for him to have his moment.
He annoys me through most of the book. And I'm like, okay, great. We get to the end and you're slightly less annoying.
Okay. So how does annoying translate to the Enneagram?
I'm going to upset some Enneagram types.
Well, you want to just do a rundown for him?
I'm willing to make a case.
Make a case.
I think he might be a six.
Okay.
I think he's definitely in the fear triad. I think he obviously doesn't want to do it. He gets there. He's like, I'm out. I'm ready to go back when things go sideways. He's always aware of the danger, but he's not always prepared for the danger. So that tells me he's probably not a five. He doesn't make fun of the things. He's not lighthearted. He's very mopey, and he's looking, and this is the big one for me, he's looking for that parent figure, be it Kate, be it the professor. And I know he's had some childhood trauma. It's affected some of those things. I just think he's so rooted in fear that he's reacting to everything.
I think he could be a six. I definitely don't think he's a one. I don't think he's a two. Although I wondered at the beginning because he was just so desperate for a girlfriend, but I don't think that's his two, like, need to be loved. I don't think he's a three. Although I can see that he cares about his academic career and like winning arguments and being smart, and like he wants to do well with his work, which, I mean, most people who are working in a profession want to do well, but that is a, you know, a three-ish quality. I don't think he's a four, even though he's mopey. He's definitely not a five. He could be a six because all the reasons that you just said perfectly. I wonder, I'm just kind of spitballing here because I think you're probably right, but I wonder about a seven a little bit too, because of that immaturity, the way he kind of, he's flighty. He goes from one woman to the next pretty quickly. He's not a risk taker. So I take it back. I don't think he would be quite as fearful, or that fear would manifest where he doesn't want to do things. But sometimes sevens can kind of feel like Peter Pan, where they're perpetually immature. But I think a six makes more sense for him, and also kind of rising to the occasion, because sixes, once they are in crisis mode, can sometimes be really great because they've already imagined all the ways things can go wrong. And so when it does go wrong, they just deal with it. And he does get to that point where he's dealing with it. I don't see him scanning for danger, though.
He just seems fretful.
So here's an idea. I'm not sold on it. We know he's not a seven or eight. Could he be a nine? because nines under stress act like a six.
I think that's a real possibility.
He does seem to merge a little bit. Like we see it with Sophie in the horseback riding. He doesn't particularly assert himself.
He gets caught up in other people's stuff.
And he's very snarky in his head.
Think about how easily Claire like ropes him in.
Yeah. Yeah. He's not suspicious like a six. And so anyone with guile can kind of bring him in if she's pretty. But he's very snarky in his head, as we see with Kate's friends who are like stockbroker New York type. He really, really hates them, but he'll let them buy his wine.
Bunch of posers.
I'm kind of liking the nine.
Yeah, I made the case for a six. I think you convinced me to the nine.
And that would mean, because there's, you know, nines have a relationship with the six and the three. Mm-hmm. So if he's not a nine, I think he's a six. And if he's not a six, I think he's a nine. But that would explain, he's certainly on that line.
Yeah, you say that, but if he's not a six, he's a nine or vice versa. But he's probably a nine.
And that would also make sense of kind of coming into his own power. Mm-hmm. Because when nines are healthy, they move towards a three. And he starts to get things done and be more competent. And it's like he flips a switch in himself where he's like, I'm going to rise to the occasion. And so that would make sense of his fearfulness at the beginning and his trying to get out of things. And Andre's like, nope, you're coming, man. And he goes with it. He lets Andre tell him what to do. He puts his life on the line because Andre says, nah, you can do it. He's like, okay.
I mean, to be fair, you would do anything Andre asked you to do.
I would.
I would as well.
Especially if Andre being portrayed by a young Gerard Butler. Mm, that yeah. Didn't hurt in his long hair phase. I have different feelings. Like Gerard Butler in, was it 300? Nope. Doesn't do it for me. Not at all.
Really?
Really. Like, I like his character, but his physicality, like, no, it's not the aesthetic that I'm drawn to.
You're almost too physically attractive at this point. It's too much Gerard.
It's too high maintenance. That's what it is. I'm not interested in someone who's high maintenance about their body.
I mean, because
then I feel like I need to be high maintenance about mine, and a homegirl likes Oreos.
I mean, at that point, if he were doing household chores, he could wash the clothes on those abs.
Well, he had eight of them. He did. But he also couldn't eat. He had to work out like crazy. And I don't love the beard and the short hair. I like the longer hair on him. Yeah. I'm liking a nine for Chris.
Yeah, I am too.
Well, we've done it again.
We got there on some numbers we never thought we would do.
Yeah. Honestly, I had an idea. I had a pretty good idea for Lady Claire and a pretty good idea for Andre. But that was it. Coming into recording, we definitely talked it out together.
We always do, Kate. Teamwork. We get there. We convince ourselves of things. And then the internet changes our minds. Sometimes it just riles us up. Like, no, we're right. I'm still bitter about how Luisa got typed from Encanto. Like, we're right on this one. Like,
we are 100% right.
I will die on that hill.
Yeah. Everybody else, you just cray. You just cray cray. Mm-hmm. Well, if you guys enjoyed this month's book club, then you'll probably enjoy next month's book club, because we are going to be reading The Wheel of Time. And this is one of your favorites, isn't it?
It is. Robert Jordan, so good, so good. Unfortunately, he died before he was unable to complete it. And we had Brandon Sanderson come along and just do a phenomenal job.
Yeah, if you're going to have someone finish your series, Brandon Sanderson's probably the ideal person to do it.
Yeah, but he was not a well-known author at the time. He had really only published, I think, one book, maybe two. But you're about to dive into this. Welcome to the world of fantasy. You're getting into some high fantasy, Kate. How's it feel?
Well, I haven't started it yet, so I'll let you know when we get there. But you know, you haven't steered me wrong yet, so I've really liked the books that you've picked out for us.
I think this one was a request, wasn't it?
I don't remember.
It feels like a while ago someone asked us to do this one.
It makes sense. Which leads us to our next point, that if there's a book that you want us to read for the Nerdogram Book Club, or a show or a movie that you'd really like us to watch, then just slide into our DMs or comment on one of our posts. We have so far done every request that a listener has given to us. So unless it's like way off the wall or just for whatever reason we can't make it happen, we're probably going to make it happen because we want to be in conversation with our listeners. So you can always get in touch with us on Instagram. We're pretty active there at Nerdogram Podcast. You can also go to our website, nerdogrampodcast.com. And we would really love it if you would get in contact with us through the rate, review, and comment features on whatever your podcast listening app is. Those things just help us get more attention so that other people can find the podcast. We think you guys must be doing that because we're seeing it being shared. So thank you for all of you who have recommended it to a friend. For those of you who get on there and find one episode and then binge all the others, that just really warms our heart and makes us feel like what we're doing matters.
It does. Well, that's all for me.
And that's all for me.